Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
How does summer in Seattle sound? Each summer, Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture sponsors two intensive 9-day seminars. Our next session is from July 8th to the 16th in Seattle, at the height of the most beautiful time of the year in the Pacific Northwest, when you can study the mystery of nature while enjoying its splendor as well. You can apply now for our intensive 9-day seminar on intelligent design at discovery.org. The CSC Seminar in Intelligent Design in the Natural Sciences will prepare students to make research contributions advancing the growing science of intelligent design. The seminar explores cutting-edge ID work in fields such as molecular biology, embryology, developmental biology, computational biology, ID theoretic mathematics, cosmology, physics, and the history and philosophy of science. The C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society will explore the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts during the past century. Sponsored by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, these are amazing opportunities intended primarily for upper division undergraduates and graduate students, plus a select group of professors, scientists, teachers, pastors, and other professionals. If you're not a candidate for this program yourself, but know students who might be, please help us by referring students here, encouraging them to apply as soon as possible. They can get more information at discovery.org. That's discovery.org. Thank you, and now back to ID the Future.
Greetings, and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. We have on the show with us today Dr. Anne Gager, Senior Research Scientist at the Biologic Institute, and we're going to talk to her about her new paper published in the journal Biocomplexity, The Evolutionary Accessibility of New Enzyme Functions, a Case Study from the Biotin Pathway. So, Dr. Gager, thanks for coming on the show with us.
Thanks, Casey. It's good to be here.
Well, we often hear stories from evolutionary biologists about purported attempts to evolve enzyme A into enzyme B. But rarely do we find people who are actually willing to test exactly how many changes are necessary to evolve enzyme A into enzyme B, and then determine whether or not those are the kinds of changes which are accessible by a Darwinian mechanism. Your new paper in Biocomplexity attempted to tackle that question. So maybe if you could first explain to our listeners, what was the problem that you tried to address in your paper, and how did you go about doing it?
Well, in order for evolution to be able to account for what we see in life, it has to be able to generate novelty, new things, innovations that haven't been present before. But it is an approachable problem if you look at the evolution of proteins, because proteins are the building blocks of life, and they can be grouped into families and superfamilies based on how they compare with one another. Their structure, the three-dimensional structure, shows that they have similar three-dimensional folding, and the backbone chain of the proteins align and similarly in space. Based on those similarities, biologists group them into families and superfamilies, and they infer from the similarities that they came from common ancestors. So if it's the case that we have a whole diversity of different proteins sharing similar structure and derived from common ancestry, then that means it must be possible for Darwinian evolution to accomplish such changes in a stepwise fashion. We set out to test how many changes are required to convert one enzyme into another, not starting from the question of the position of common ancestry, but just saying, okay, let's pick two proteins that are very similar in structure, that share a lot of features, but where one has a different chemistry than the other. So we set out to test how hard it is to accomplish these kinds of conversions. How many mutations does it take to change one enzyme's function to a new function? That's the basic approach. It's testable because we can isolate what kinds of changes are necessary and then test to see whether they achieve the conversion that we're hoping for. And that gives us a sort of a baseline for how hard it is to convert one enzyme to another.
What you and Dr. Axe are studying here is supposedly a process that has taken place many times in the history of biochemical evolution, the transformation of one enzyme into a very similar enzyme that perhaps has a slightly different function. So obviously you had to choose two enzymes to work with here, and there are a lot of enzymes out there. So how did you choose the two specific enzymes that you chose to try to test here at whether or not enzyme A essentially could be mutated to evolve into enzyme B?
We chose to work with a family of enzymes called the PLP-dependent transferases, and we chose this family because it's one of the largest families of structurally similar enzymes in life. It's been well characterized. There are lots of enzymes whose structures have been determined, yet it also is a family that carries out a broad diversity of reactions. The chemistries of these enzymes can differ quite widely. So we started out by comparing the structures of all the enzymes in the family, more than 50 of them, one by one with each other. And we used a computer program to come up with a numerical value that represented how similar they were to each other. The smaller the numerical value, the more similar they were. The larger, the less similar in structure. We looked at all those enzymes and we determined which of them had the greatest similarity, which pairs had the greatest similarity. Then we looked at the chemistry of those pairs that were very similar in structure and looked to see if they had similar chemistry or distinctly different chemistry. We wanted to study a conversion that would require an innovation, a new chemistry. We didn't want to just look at slightly modifying substrate preferences or that sort of thing. So we looked for pairs where they were very similar in structure but had different chemistry.
And of course, again, this is the sort of transformation which has supposedly taken place countless times in the history of evolution, where the way that you get an enzyme is by modifying a similar enzyme that perhaps fulfills a different biochemical function. So you started with two different enzymes, KBL and BioF. And it's my understanding that you tried to determine what it would take to evolve KBL into BioF. And your experiment went through a three-step process to make this determination, or at least what are the bare minimum number of changes at the amino acid level that you would have to make in KBL to achieve the function of BioF. So can you maybe walk our listeners through those three steps and how you determined the bare minimum number of changes that would be necessary to essentially evolve enzyme A into enzyme B, so to speak?
Okay, a little background on the two enzymes we chose. KBL is an enzyme that's involved in threonine degradation and metabolism. Threonine is an essential amino acid. And BioF is involved in the production of the vitamin biotin. We chose to look to see if we could turn KBL into a biotin-producing enzyme because there's an easy selection we can use for checking to see if the enzyme is now converted. Any cell that lacks the BioF enzyme can't grow. But if it receives a mutated version of KBL that is now able to make biotin, the cells can grow. So it makes for an easy screen. The three steps we used to study this problem were, first, to identify what particular amino acids were the most likely candidates to be important for function in the BioF enzyme. And we did that by first looking at the sequence of a bunch of different BioF enzymes. We aligned them and determined which of the amino acid positions were highly conserved among BioFs in general. And then we looked to see, of those conserved positions in BioF, how many of them were different in KBL. And the ones that were different in KBL were the ones we picked as candidates to test. We also aligned KBL and BioF structurally so that their active sites overlapped. And then we looked to see what amino acids in the region of the active site, and that's the business end of the enzyme where the chemistry is carried out. We looked to see which of those amino acids in the region of the active site differed between KBL and BioF. Now, I should say, KBL and BioF, the amino acids in the active site that actually carry out the chemistry, they're already identical. So these are additional positions that surround the active site but that aren't directly involved in the chemistry. So how many different positions are we talking about? Well, 15 individual mutations to test, and then three groups in the region of the active site of about six or seven amino acids each. Those were our candidates to start out. We tested all of them by a simple procedure. We took BioF, the enzyme, and mutated each of the positions to be tested to look like KBL. Mm-hmm. It should be a fairly conservative substitution since those two enzymes are so similar. And then we asked, does the BioF enzyme still work when it's got that single mutation? The answer was, of the 15 individual positions that we tested, only one of them knocked out the function of the BioF enzyme. So that one position by itself is essential for BioF activity. Then we looked at the three groups, and we knocked out all of the group at once. So in the case of group one, it would be six amino acids converted to look like cable in BioF. And changing those six amino acids was sufficient to knock out BioF activity. Same thing was true for group two. Same thing was true for group three. Now, we'd already looked at group three had seven residues in it, I believe, seven different amino acids in the group. We'd already looked at four of them individually because they were part of our individual candidates. Mm-hmm. So we looked at the other remaining single amino acids within group three. None of them singly were enough to knock out function, but the group as a whole did. So now we have four different groups of amino acids that we know are essential for BioF activity. They have to be BioF-like, not cable-like. We assume that those are the most important residues for having BioF activity. Now we're going to go back to cable. This is the third step in the process, and change cable to look like BioF in those positions. So we tested them all singly and in combination. The single amino acid change, when we took cable and made it look like BioF, had no effect. Each of the groups changed in cable to look like BioF, didn't convert it to BioF function, and all of them in combination didn't succeed in converting cable to function like BioF. That represents 20-some amino acid changes. Now, given that the amino acid length of the enzyme itself is on the order of 398 amino acids, 20 amino acids out of 398 is a small proportion to change, but it's still a substantial number for Darwinian evolution to accomplish. But we wanted to be really conservative in our estimate of what the minimum number of changes necessary. And since we didn't test each of those groups singly, with each position tested by itself, we then backpedaled on our estimate. We said, okay, we know we need one single amino acid, H152. We know we need at least one amino acid from group one. We know we need at least one from group two. And since we tested all of the positions in group three singly, we could say we need at least two from group three. That represents five amino acid substitutions. And in terms of base changes, based on the particular residues that need to be changed, it represents a minimum of seven nucleotide substitutions that would have to occur to convert cable to BioF. Now, seven nucleotide substitutions, how hard is it to get seven specific nucleotide substitutions? That's the next question.
Well, Dr. Gager, I think that we're running out of time for this first podcast, and this is actually a great breaking point. We'll come back in the next podcast and explain to our listeners why this number of seven, a minimum number, at the very least, of seven required mutations to change cable into BioF is very significant for the evolutionary implications of whether or not an enzyme like BioF could have evolved by Darwinian processes. So will you stay with us for a second podcast?
Of course.
Okay, well, I'm Casey Lusk, and stay tuned for more on ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.